precisely how do principles of Austrian economics translate into effective winning business practices? Clay Miller is here to give us five examples.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast. Entrepreneurs are champions for customers, improving their lives with preferred products and services, value, and innovation. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one by building a beautiful business. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. The bridge that we keep talking about, from Austrian economics to effective business practice, how is it constructed? Well, to maintain the analogy, there must be solid support pillars and a framework of cables and connectors, and then a bridge structure and the surface roadway, which takes users from one side to the other. We're in the process of construction, and users, people in business aiming for success in commercial exchanges, will tell us how well we're doing, because they'll test the bridge and its components and tell us how well it serves their needs to get from where they are today to where they want to be in the future. Today, we're going to discuss some of the pillars and connections. We'll identify five conceptual pillars, and then we'll connect them to contemporary business practices and show how they guide the way for today's innovative, digitalized, value-centric service provision business systems. We're going to start with textual content, because we're drawing on the genius of economic thinkers who did their work before YouTube and Instagram. The genius is still relevant. To make an analogy, Benoit Mandelbrot was a French mathematician who made enormous contributions to the theory of fractal geometry, the self-similarity in shapes that we observe in coastlines, trees, snowflakes, and galaxies. It turns out that fractal geometry has analytical and explanatory power in the very 21st century applications, such as complexity science, adaptive systems, power distributions in networks, and information theory applied to biology and evolution. Mandelbrot's 20th century discoveries are invaluable and essential to 21st century understanding. Economics has its Mandelbrots, geniuses of the past to inform the geniuses and innovative thinkers of the present in essential ways. Perhaps today's thinkers can find new and expanded applications of the core concepts, but they certainly can't do without them. We all stand on the shoulders of giants, as Isaac Newton said. Let's explore a few genius expressions of economics for business. Today's guest is Clay Miller, whom you met in episode 83. Clay is a technology entrepreneur, founder of Life Logics, a tech firm serving the organ and tissue transplant industry, and CEO of a global technology outsourcing firm operating in the fintech, mobile security, and AI spaces. Clay, welcome back to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Thank you.
You're a technology entrepreneur. You're on the cutting edge of modern business applications and innovations. You work in advanced fields, including artificial intelligence. You've worked in ultra-modern service fields like organ transplant coordination. And you've pioneered modern organizational innovations like the external CTO, Chief Technology Officer, that you told us about last time you were here, and the globally distributed programming team. And at the same time, you're an avid student of Austrian economics, and you credit that discipline with helping you to be a business success. It's knowledge that you can apply, in other words. So today, what I'd like to do is dig deep into some of your favorite Austrian knowledge. But maybe as a start, we could ask you to point listeners to some general principles of the Austrian knowledge base that you believe are instrumental, and then we'll step through some specifics. So what kind of general principle would you present to people?
Well, the Austrian school looks at individual human action as a base component of driving the rest of economic action in a market. And understanding consumer sovereignty, understanding the concept of your customers as an individual, not just a blob of data, but as an individual with unique needs and wants and and interacting with people on an individual, personalized level. I think that is very important. Understanding uncertainty and how to make decisions under uncertainty. Those are things that the Austrian school is very adept at explaining. And really, the Austrian school and Austrian economics gives us a framework for interpretation of what we see around us in our businesses and the data that we see from our customers. Without a framework for interpretation, understanding what we see actually means to us, it's very difficult to make actionable decisions on data. So that's one thing that Austrian economics does for me personally.
Good. Well, we've adopted the saying that you can think better if you think Austrian when it comes to business, and that's mm-hmm. another way of communicating what you just said. So what we thought we might do together today is have you pick out a few of some of your favorite texts or ideas or principles that come from Austrian economics, things that some of our listeners can read for themselves and think through themselves. So let's do that today and tell us where you're going to start.
Yeah, I think a good introduction into Austrian thought, and it's a very small article. It's not difficult to read, but it's Hayek's Use of Knowledge in Society. It was written back in 1945 and is actually part of a series of articles that Hayek wrote. And the purpose of the article is actually talking about how central planners in an economy are not really knowledgeable enough about the nuances and individual details enough to make decisions on what prices should be. So at that point in time, there was a lot of academic research supporting price controls and centrally planned economies where central planners and bureaus could set prices for different goods. And the entire point of his article was that we don't have enough information to be able to do that accurately. But in the business side, it also has a lot of applications, especially in terms of what we know, how much we're able to do with what we know, and really how to understand the metrics and business data that we see coming in from our customers. Big data is something that is prevalent today. Analytics, business analytics across almost every field are something that people deal with every single day, whether it's tools like Google Analytics or business intelligence software that people are using to look at their customers and their income and customer preferences and those types of things. And a lot of artificial intelligence software uses very complex analytical algorithms and statistical algorithms to do analysis on the data that it has. And the problem is that a lot of data is actionable, but there are many KPIs in your business in terms of business intelligence data metrics that you may come in contact with that have too much aggregation in them. And what we mean by that is there are too many there's too much aggregation in the statistic itself to where you can't tell the nuances of the data that's underneath it. So it makes it very difficult to make actionable decisions on it. Usually, Austrians, we use the same logic to criticize things like GDP, which is such a large aggregated number that it's almost meaningless when you're actually talking about what's really happening in the economy. But in your business, it actually has the same effect. When you have too much aggregation, it smooths out and hides the underlying individual consumer principles that you're trying to identify in order to make your business better. Hayek, the quote that I like in this particular article is he's referring to statistics and central planning. And he says, the statistics which such a central authority would have to use would have to be arrived at precisely by abstracting from minor differences between the things, by lumping together as resources of one kind, items which differ as regards to location, quality, and other particulars in a way which may be very significant for the specific decision. It follows from this that central planning based on statistical information by its nature cannot take direct account of those circumstances of time and place. And so what he's saying is that a lot of statistical information, even though we can calculate those things, cannot tell us what to do with that information. It doesn't allow us to interpret actionable items and action to take on that data. So I think one of the principles is that, first of all, we need to be careful of too much aggregation in our data. An example of a metric that is used in business that I think has too much aggregation is average revenue per customer. And the calculation is very simple. You take all of your revenue across all of your customers and divide them by the number of customers you have, and you get an average of how much revenue you have recognized per customer. The problem with this is that your data has to be very uniform across all of your customers for it to be worth any real actionable intelligence. I'll give you an example of 10 customers. Let's say you have 10 customers and 9 of those customers spend $100 as a customer with your business, and one person spends $1,000. If you just look at the average metric, every customer comes out to be $190 in revenue per customer. But you can't say from that statistic that every new customer that you get will probably spend $190 with you, because actually the pattern is much more likely that they'll only spend $100. The $1,000 is an outlier that throws off your entire metric. And so what you really need to understand is the individual customers. What's distinct about this $1,000 customer that made them spend $1,000 with you? Are there things that we can learn from this customer that we can also take to improve the sales of our other customers, improve the value proposition that we're making to other customers? So those types of things are the dangers in aggregation. So the second thing that we need to think about is trying to choose metrics that give us an insight in terms of the individual customer behavior. A good example is something like Google Analytics. When you're analyzing website data, let's say that you've got all of your website traffic and you're looking at different pages on your website and watching the time that individual users spend on the website, and you come up with a statistic like every customer that spends more than 7 minutes on your website converts 45% of the time to a actual sale. That's actionable information because it allows you to profile the type of customer that's interacting with you. It lets you know what content they're engaging with and what they're responding to. By the same token, on the negative side, you could also say maybe you have a content page that's part of your sales flow on your website that you notice has a 30% higher abandon rate, which means when people hit the page in 1 or 2 seconds, they jump off. And maybe you've got a 30% higher abandon rate on this particular web page than your other pages in your site. Well, what that may tell you is there's either content that's off-putting to the customer, maybe the page loads too slowly and they don't want to wait on it and abandon the session. All of those things produce accurate information. So we want actionable information. We want statistics that we can actually use to identify how we can serve customers better. And then the last thing that we need to consider in terms of the use of knowledge in our business is we need to understand the boundaries of what your data can actually tell you. Correlation does not necessarily equal causation. A good example of this, let's say you've got a restaurant and you notice that on Tuesdays, your lunch orders are 30% higher than any other day of the week. That's a correlation, but it's probably not happening because it's Tuesday. The fact that it's Tuesday is not driving the fact that your lunch orders are 30% higher. Maybe there's an office nearby that one of their perks for their employees is they give a per diem every Tuesday for their staff to go out and have lunch for free or something like that. maybe that's what's driving it. So in our search for a meaning in statistics, we need to understand that just because two things correlate doesn't mean there's a causal relationship between those two things. And we need to dig into the causal relationships between those things that we identify in our business metrics. So that's one important thing. And I think that's one good entry point into Austrian thought that doesn't take a big leap. It doesn't take a lot of time to read Hayek's article.
We are talking with Clay Miller about applications of Austrian economics and business. Six of our leading professors, Professors Per Byland, Peter Klein, Mark Packard, Matt McCaffrey, Vishal Gupta, and Steve Phelan, provided parallel views on this same subject in our free ebook, Austrian Economics and Contemporary Business Applications. It's immensely valuable to business people. You can get it free at e4epod.com/ebook. That's the letter E, the number 4, the letter E, pod.com/ebook. And now back to our conversation. Yeah, and that deep digging into cause and effect is one of the aspects of Austrianism, I think, that's useful for entrepreneurs. The other thing I take away from the Hayek reading is that knowledge and data are different things. There's a room for both of them, but knowledge includes subjectivity of the individual that you're trying to gather knowledge on. It includes values. It's got a time dimension. It's got a lot of things that are not included in data. And especially when trying to understand customers, I think, the qualitative data, one interview with one customer, is often more valuable than a lot of big data about a lot of customers that you point out are being averaged and are impersonal. So that's a good place to start.
Right.
Well, thank you for that insight on Hayek's use of knowledge. Let's go to your next selected text, Clay. Where should we go next?
Well, I think that Mises and his smaller book, Bureaucracy, also is a very interesting book because the entire book is primarily, obviously, focused on the inefficiencies and ineffectiveness and mixed incentives in a bureaucratic structure, whether it's political or in a firm. But one of the things that he talks about under a chapter called Profit Management is actually consumer sovereignty. And this is something that is extremely important in terms of Austrian thought. And this is central to creating good value propositions for your business. And that's to understand that the consumer is the one who is actually in control of production. Now, we think of our businesses, our firms as being ours, and maybe we're a director or a chairman of the board or something like that. But the truth is the director is the consumer. Because if the consumer is not willing to pay for what we're producing, then we don't exist. So they're the ones who are actually driving everything. So one of the short quotes from Bureaucracy is, Mises says, "Thus, the capitalist system of production is an economic democracy in which every penny gives the right to vote. Consumers are the sovereign people. The capitalists, entrepreneurs, and the farmers are the people's mandatories. If they do not obey, if they fail to produce at the lowest possible cost what the consumers are asking for, they lose their office." And so the point of this short sentence is that the consumers are really the ones who are driving the production. And it's up to us to make sure that every decision that we make in the business is toward the purpose of bettering our value proposition to those customers. A good example is, let's say you're starting a restaurant and you're trying to decide which decor to use. You could think, well, I'm the entrepreneur, I can choose the style that I like, or maybe I'll just hire a interior designer and let them make the choice. But actually, we need to think about the value experience that the customer may like, and that requires empathy.
And consumer sovereignty and empathy go together because consumers are the ones who are valuing what is produced. They're the ones who are ascribing value to a product or service that an entrepreneur produces. And the entrepreneur needs to anticipate what they value. And so the closer you match what customers value in the real world, the more profitability you'll have, the closer that you get to estimating and anticipating what the customer wants. So if you're starting a restaurant, for example, we need to think about what experience we're trying to create for the customer, and everything revolves around that. I'm from North Carolina in the South, and we have a lot of barbecue restaurants. And if you go into a barbecue restaurant, there's an expectation that it's going to be probably plastic plates and, you know, small booths that are not necessarily that comfortable, but it's cheap and easy food to eat and usually delicious. But you can't do that for a five-star restaurant. There's a different expectation. The customer has a different value experience that they're expecting. So every decision that the entrepreneur makes needs to be driven by the consumer. And even when you're starting a business, before you have customers, before you really know what the market feedback is for your products and services, it's a good idea to imagine a perfect customer, create a construct of, and personally, I actually use more than one. Usually, I like to think of what I call different customer profiles. I imagine different profiles of a customer and think through the value that they may be trying to get. And we try to figure out which profiles that we're going to target and how we're going to target those customer profiles. And then, of course, when you are producing the product or service, now you have to get feedback from your customers to see how do they value it? Do they value it? At how much are they willing to pay for it? That's called price discovery. That's something that's also uniquely Austrian concept that we'll talk about a little bit later. But consumer sovereignty and empathy, every decision that we make inside the business needs to be for the purpose of and directed toward improving a value proposition to the customer.
I was reading a case study recently about a firm, GE Appliances, which was an old company that had become locked into bureaucracy. It was acquired by a Chinese company, I think, called Haier, H-A-I-E-R. And they had the philosophy of the customer is the boss.
Mm-hmm.
And so they try to create organizational changes and redesigns that bring that into practice, which includes breaking down the business into many, many small businesses so you can be closer and closer to the customer all the time. Making the people who actually contact the customer and the consumer, the ones with the most influence and power. And to your point about Mises's book, the CEO of GE Appliances was giving a presentation about how to do this. He had 10 points. Point number one was defeat the bureaucracy because it gets in the way of the customer's boss. The bureaucracy is there to stop the customer from being the boss. And then he went through a whole number of other principles. And then number eight is keep fighting the bureaucracy because it keeps coming back. It doesn't understand the customer. It wants to lock into processes and methods and rules that don't reflect the customer. So
right.
You're exactly right about the customer as the boss. It's a hard thing to do. And I think smaller, more entrepreneurial companies have a much easier time doing that, certainly right. A greater opportunity because the bureaucracy hasn't taken them over yet.
And that's actually one of the arguments that Austrians make against the monopolization of corporations. There's a feeling that monopolies will naturally exist in a free market because these companies will just grow larger and larger and suddenly they will take over and push everyone else out of the market. And the fact is that in a truly open society in a free market, that does not happen because of this principle right here. As things grow, the knowledge gets interspersed It's always decentralized, but it's interspersed throughout the organization at different levels, and it gets much harder to control, much harder to manage, and bureaucratic institutions normally come in and take the place and take root in the firm in order to solve some of those problems. And then the larger corporation usually becomes unwieldy, and the bureaucratic institutions that are inside that firm create opportunities for entrepreneurs to come in and actually take business away from those larger firms.
Right. Yes, so it's got great implications for organization and scale. How you implement scale.
Right.
Good. Well, let's keep going, Clay. Let's have you introduce another one of your favorite texts.
Well, you can't talk about Austrian economics without talking about human action. So in every discussion of Austrian economics, you have to at least reference human action one time. So the challenge with human action is it's a bit of a larger text, and it's more than 900 pages, and takes some time to go through the content because it's deep philosophical content. But the good thing about human action is a lot of the chapters can be read standalone, and you can actually gain a lot of valuable insight from them. So even if you just have time to read like one chapter or one unit, then you can still gain an understanding of a lot of the Austrian concepts that will be valuable to your business. And one of those is what we call value scales. Everyone has a value scale. And I won't attempt to describe it. I'll just read it. And I think Mises describes the concept of value scales very easily. He says, it's customary to say that acting man has a scale of wants or values in his mind when he arranges his actions. On the basis of such a scale, he satisfies what is of higher value, i.e., his more urgent wants, and leaves unsatisfied what is of lower value, i.e., what is a less urgent want. So this is a very core concept in Austrian economics, and we will hear professors use the term urgently held want, and that comes from human action, because when someone is making a decision to purchase your product or service, they are evaluating that not just on the merits of your marketing, not just on the merits of how they feel about it. They are actually doing quite a complex valuation process in their mind, fitting in your product or service into a scale of values of what they want. And so customer values are constantly changing. This is another challenging thing. We can't think of customers as just static robots. And once you kind of pinpoint the profile of a customer, that customer profile is never going to change because people's situations are constantly changing. People lose their jobs. We've had situations with COVID. You've got someone who's has a child and they're saving for college or they're saving for a house in the future, so they may forego consumption on a car. Whereas if they're just maybe 20 years old and renting an apartment, they would have bought the car. So these types of things are constantly changing as people go through their lives. I think a good example is, for example, let's say that you own a Krispy Kreme donut franchise and you have a customer that comes in religiously every single day and buys a donut, and then suddenly they stop coming and you find out that they decided they wanted to go on a diet and lose weight. What they're telling you is that their value scale has changed. Prior to them going on a diet, they valued the experience of the Krispy Kreme donut more than they valued losing weight. But they decided that today I'm going to change my mind and I'm actually going to value losing weight and fitness and things like that, the experience that I gained from that, more than I value the experience of the Krispy Kreme donut. Understanding where the customer's value scales are moving will also help you target different types of customers with the value proposition. Because in our example of your Krispy Kreme donut shop, just because someone decides they want to go on a diet does not necessarily mean that you've lost that customer because their value scales change completely. What we can do is we can, again, imagine, empathize with that customer and think about the value experience that they might get in the future from your product and try to create a value proposition or marketing plan to meet that estimated value in the future. So if I'm the owner of the Krispy Kreme franchise, maybe I'll create a promotion called the Cheat Day promotion. Because I'm imagining this customer, they're working hard at the gym. They, you know, they love Krispy Kreme donuts, obviously, because they've religiously been a customer for years. They've lost 5 or 10 pounds. They've worked very hard at it. They deserve to have a cheat day. And so maybe we can target that and create a value proposition around something like that to target this customer and their value scale. It's almost like a quarterback reading a route and throwing a football to where a receiver will be, where he thinks they will run. And you're able to kind of predict, using empathy again, different value scales of the customers that you have. And as you said before, Hunter, one interview with a customer may provide you more actionable information than, you know, an entire suite of data analytics. And so understanding your customers, understanding their value scales. But I will say this, you know, incidentally, value scales make some type of customer surveys useless, because there are a lot of customer surveys in market research where people ask things like, how much would you be willing to pay for X? Well, you can only observe a customer's value scale when the decision is made, after he acts. So you can't tell from what he says he would pay for something that that's actually true. You can only observe the value after the customer finishes acting, because I may ask someone, you know, how much would you be willing to pay for this Ferrari? And they may say $250,000. But that doesn't mean that they actually can pay $250,000 for this Ferrari. Or if they were presented with the opportunity, they would have to weigh that against all of their other values in order to actually take that action. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Is it important to observe customers' value scales? But it's much better to do it with customers that you can actually interact with rather than and you can observe their actions rather than surveying about what might hypothetically a customer do in the future.
A quick note. Did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4EPod. That's MISES.org/E4E. POD, and click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
Yeah, Mark Packard has a concept in his value learning process called relative value, which is the assessment that the customer goes through. So they look at your Krispy Kreme donut, to continue your analogy. Does it have absolute value? Would I like to have one? Yes. But then they calculate, what's its relative value? And it's relative to other things I could do, which includes refraining from the donut and perhaps saving a calorie or two and losing weight. And at one point in time, for one customer, that relative value may be the one that they prefer, and on another day it might not. So it's a very challenging role for the entrepreneur to keep up with the customer's changing value scales. And the only way to do it is be close to them and understand how they're feeling at all points in time.
That's correct. And in terms of even customer research and market research, that's something also when you're creating a company and doing market research, you need to be very careful about how you structure that research to make sure that you're not missing your anticipation of what the customer values, because really that is what the entrepreneur is rewarded for. You're rewarded for estimating correctly what the customer values and anticipating their wants and creating a value proposition to meet that. That's really the sole job of the entrepreneur, is to coordinate production to meet customer wants. And it's easier said than done, that's for sure.
Right. Well, Clay, let's keep rolling here. What do you have for us next?
Yeah, so I think the next thing that I would like to focus on is actually an older book by Israel Kirzner. And he wrote a seminal work called Competition and Entrepreneurship. And a lot of modern entrepreneurism theory was derived from this book, and is this book is referenced often in scholarly articles. And one of the things that he talks about in his book is the fact that the market is a process of discovery. That's how the market operates. And you have to think of the market in that way as an entrepreneur to understand what's actually happening. Information is distributed across the market in uneven ways. You as an entrepreneur have some uncertainty about what you're producing, how the customers are going to value what you're producing. At the same time, your customers also have some uncertainty about the value, about how they're going to value what you produce. So there's some trepidation on both parts. If you and we all know this from being consumers. If you've ever had a purchase to make and you're really wondering, you're really struggling whether to pull the trigger and actually buy this or not, because you don't know for sure whether the quality is going to be what you expect. You're not sure if the customer service is going to be there for you if you have to return it or something like that. But the whole process of the market is actually discovery. There is a discovery on the side of the entrepreneur as he or she produces products and services, presents that value proposition to the market. We discover how much people value that, how much people are willing to pay for it, how much they're willing to fit that in with their other costs that they have, the opportunity costs that they have. For every dollar they spend on your business, they or your product or service, they forego spending that same dollar at some other with some other experience. So there's a discovery process on the entrepreneur side, but also on the customer side, there is a discovery process about, did your product or service match their expectations of value, what they had in their mind, the experience they thought they were going to have? Did they achieve that? And so Kirzner actually, I'll read just a short quote here. He says, the market process then is set in motion by the results of the initial market ignorance of the participants. So this means that both sides, there's ignorance on both sides. The entrepreneur is unsure about the customer, and the customer is also unsure about the experience they're going to get interacting with the entrepreneur. He says the process itself consists of a systematic plan changes generated by the flow of market information released by market participation, that is, by testing of plans in the market. And that's really how the market is. As an entrepreneur, we are trying to anticipate what our customers are going to value. And so that's why we use empathy, in order to imagine, if we were the customer, what type of experience would we be looking for, thinking, putting ourselves in someone else's shoes, and then trying to give them the experience that we anticipate that they're going to enjoy. And so the better that we do that, and the better that we deliver on that that proposition to the customer, and the more that they agree with our value proposition. So we're giving them a proposition saying, hey, try our product or service. We offer you this type of feeling, this type of experience. the more they agree with that and say, yes, your product or service did delivered on what you promised me or the proposition that you made to me, the better your business will do. And then this also has implications for branding, because branding has value in the market in terms of reputation, because you're able to accrue a certain amount of reputation as the market learns more about your product or service. A good example of this is, things like cars, Mercedes-Benz, for example. There is a certain level of reputation that Mercedes has built up over the years that people have a value experience, a positive value experience with Mercedes-Benz, and they have earned a certain reputation. When Mercedes produces a car, whether it's a CLS or an S-Class or whatever, customers just need to see the three-pointed star. When they see that logo, they have a natural reaction to the reputation that has been earned over, more than a century now of producing cars. So that's something that almost no mainstream economists even think about, is branding and how branding actually affects your business, because you can't put that into an equation. How much is your brand worth? Well, that is very, very difficult to have a valuation on that. It is subjective in the market, but there, brands can be a repository to hold that stored reputation that the market has discovered about your product or service. And over time, that brand can actually even allow you some leniency in the market. There are some poor cars that have been produced by different companies with strong brands. And they're able to overcome that because customers may buy it just because of that accrued reputation. Now, you can't mess up too many times and fail on your value proposition. But as the market learns you, your brand actually represents a kind of a stored experience for them. And they have a trust in that value proposition just because of the reputation that you've built. So the market is a process of discovery. There's discovery on both sides. And as an entrepreneur, you need to realize that in order to make your value propositions a learning process for the customer and how they learn how to value your product or service.
One of the words that always comes to my mind listening to that Austrian clarity and how markets work and how businesses succeed is humility. We're often taught in a business school kind of context or in the business books written about the great CEOs and strategists, and they're masters of the universe. They've somehow brilliantly mastered their circumstances. But in fact, the opposite is the case. It's the humility to be able to discover where value lies for customers. And as you said, testing your plans in the marketplace, you don't know exactly what's going to happen, so you have to test it. And there's a kind of humility that's required there that I think is particularly Austrian and a useful way for entrepreneurs to think.
Right. I agree with that.
Well, I think you're going to bring us into the 21st century with your fifth reading, Clay. So let's hear about that.
Yeah, so we have some great modern Austrian thinkers, especially on the entrepreneurship side. Peter Klein, Per Bieland, all of those individuals are making great strides in Austrian theory, especially in firm theory of the firm and those types of things. One of the great insights from Foss and Klein in their work, Austrian Perspectives on Entrepreneurship, Strategy, and Organization. It's a long title, but in chapter 4, they discuss something called social entrepreneurship. And this is something that's kind of a new idea that has come about. Really, I've noticed it more over the past decade, gaining more and more traction, especially among millennial business owners and millennial entrepreneurs. But the idea is that your business should be focused on something more than just profit and loss. Your business should provide some social value, and that you need to use your corporation or your business for good in this world, to improve the world. And the fact is that just because you as an entrepreneur are producing goods and services that customers want means that you are improving society. Steve Jobs improved society greatly by inventing the iPhone. Yes, he got rich doing it. Yes, Apple made unbelievable amounts of profit from the iPhone and the iPad and those devices. But their impact on society was much higher. You're talking about communication and productivity improvements for billions of people. So just the fact that they produced those products and services means that society inherited the benefits. But Foss and Klein in this book say Austrian theory has more to say about social entrepreneurship than its terminology. It also provides a robust framework for thinking about social enterprises and their organization. Although social ventures come in many shapes and sizes, they all must grapple with some basic economic problems. Taking on a special mission or a social mission besides simply earning profits does not relieve the firm of the pressures of the marketplace, because social enterprises are fundamentally business organizations. That is, they aspire to be independent of charitable and governmental support, and in theory at least, they earn revenue through the sale of goods and services rather than through donations and public grants. Therefore, like traditional entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs must use judgment to allocate scarce resources in the face of uncertainty. Furthermore, genuine participation in the market as commercial entities and not just charities means they are subject to the profit and loss test. And this is the point that they're making about social value, is that it's incalculable. There is no way to calculate social good. What's good for you and what's good for me may be different. We are all subjective individuals, and we are able to value things subjectively. And not all situations are good for everyone. And when you try to please one group, you may be adversely affecting another group. So the point is that profit is not evil. There is nothing wrong with creating a business that is structured for the purpose of making profit, because you cannot do that without serving your fellow man. You are automatically doing good for society by being an entrepreneur, by producing things that people want and people value. And you're foregoing your own consumption by investing in your own business, trying to produce something that you hope someone else will like. So there's really no better example of servanthood than entrepreneurship.
Ted Byland is fascinating on this topic too. He points out that businesses, or what you might call social entrepreneurship, funded by grants and subsidies and charities, might in fact be misusing society's resources, because since they don't have a profit signal for society to tell them, yes, we believe you're using resources in the best possible way, then they continue misusing resources that could be put to better use from a social perspective. So he's concurring with Professor Klein and Professor Foss. I think that's one of the big jobs, Clay, that we have, is to communicate this concept, which you just expounded, that business is good, it's not evil. To quote Professor Byland again, he talks about the ethic of entrepreneurship, that it's a service ethic. You can only succeed if you serve others and make their lives better, and they express their approval of that through the marketplace. So it's all positive, it's all ethical, there's nothing evil, and we just need to be better at communicating that, I think. So that's a good challenge for the future. Well, thank you for that that tour of some of the key texts. You and I are working together on the new Mises Institute platform that we're going to call Economics for Business. And one of our ways to capture some of the knowledge that you've just taken us through is to express it in different ways. It might be videos, it might be animated presentations, it could be readings of the short type that you talked about. You mentioned encapsulation, and we're trying to develop these knowledge capsules that people can easily read. And we'll keep working hard to get these great insights of Austrian thinkers translated for entrepreneurs in ways that they can use them every day to improve their own businesses.
Yes, we're very excited about the new platform, and we think that it will provide a lot of value to entrepreneurs and also improve their businesses. So we're looking forward to it.
Good. Well, Clay, thank you as always for today, and thank you for your brilliant insights, and we look forward to the next time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.